This is Love Your Work. On this show, we help you find your unique signature as a creative entrepreneur. I am David Cadavy. I've been a solopreneur for more than 10 years. I'm an international award-winning designer. I've written a couple best-selling books, Design for Hackers, and now The Heart to Start. From my closet in Colombia, I have interviewed titans of industry like Steve Case. I've interviewed best-selling authors like Seth Godin and James Altucher. I've interviewed experts on behavioral science, creators from dancers to a chef to a Hollywood set designer. I want to find out how each of them discovered what made them one in a million, and I bring those insights to you so you can find out what makes you one in a million too. If you are new here, welcome. Again, I'm David Cadavy. If you want to join us here on Love Your Work every Thursday, please hit subscribe on your podcast app and get my free creative productivity toolkit. Sign up at cadavy.net/tools. Is the educational system a waste of time and money? Most people can agree that schools are inefficient, boring, and expensive. I personally love learning, but I always hated school. Yet, if you're like me, you're probably also initially resistant to the idea that we should spend less on the educational system. Our guest today, Brian Kaplan, wants to make the case for spending less time, less money, and less human energy on trying to educate people. He's author of the new book, The Case Against Education: Why the Education System is a Waste of Time and Money. People make more money after earning a college degree, but Brian says that people aren't making more money because they learned more. It's just the piece of paper itself that employers care about. And if we didn't push so many people to earn college degrees and to rack up debt in the process, degrees wouldn't be a base level requirement for survival in today's job market. That's intriguing, isn't it? In this conversation, you're going to find out what is the difference between the signaling model and the human capital models of looking at education. Why is this the key to seeing education as a waste of time and money? If we cut education, won't inequality get worse? Brian tells us why he thinks that cutting education spending would actually bring more opportunity to the underprivileged. And what is the social desirability bias? Brian tells us why this bias leads us blindly into wasting time and money on so-called education. It is a thought-provoking conversation. You're bound to hear something you don't agree with if you haven't already, and you'll be forced to think about it. So hopefully you enjoy that as much as I do. Now, before we get to that conversation, I want to share another message from a Patreon supporter. Patreon supporters help bring episodes of Love Your Work to you each week. And why would you pay for something when you could just take it for free? Christian says, "It's my pleasure to contribute a few bucks to help cover your production costs. As a Patreon/open source creator myself, I know how good it feels to get feedback, but also how hard it is to get traction, and especially financial support, even after delivering a lot of value." Christian later says, "I started in a very tough period of my life just a few weeks after the birth of my baby, and even though my physical time is now very limited, by following some of the advice I got from your podcast or from the recommended books, I've been reading more books, wasting less time, and having more time for actually doing more things that really matter for myself and my family, and overall living a much happier life than before. I can't thank you enough for doing this." That is truly amazing. It's amazing to read these things because I really get chills every single time I read one of these. My favorite part, Christian, is hearing that you're finding more time for things that matter to you. It's funny how you can find new ways to grow even when it seems like there's no way you could possibly find the time. If you are like Christian and Love Your Work is helping you grow, if it's helping you invest in yourself and cut out the noise to focus in this world that's always trying to get a piece of your attention, I could really use your help to keep this show going. You'll be helping bring Love Your Work to thousands of people like Christian. Support Love Your Work on Patreon at cadavy.net/donate. Just imagine all the money you might spend in a month on teas or coffees, just a coffee a month, maybe $5. Some people do 15, or some people even do 25. It can really go a long way. Again, that is cadavy.net/donate. Now, here is Brian Kaplan. I'm here with Brian Kaplan, and Brian wrote the book, The Case against education, why education is a waste of time and money. And Brian, when I have told people that I was going to talk to you, I get an interesting reaction. There is one, people kind of intuitively agree with this idea that the education system is not working as well as it should, yet at the same time, they're very resistant to the idea that education is a waste of time and money. Is that a reaction that you have come across yourself? And if so, why do you think that people have that reaction?
Right. Well, no, the subtitle is Why the Education System is a Waste of Time and Money, not Why Education is Time and Money. And actually, this is really the heart of the book.
That tells you right there.
Yes. Yeah. The heart of the book is saying that education generally does pay well for the individual, but it's just not a very good social investment. And again, the argument is that the main reason why education pays so much in the labor market is that you are impressing employers, you're jumping through a bunch of hoops, you're getting stickers on your forehead, which is a great way for personal advancement, but it's not a great way to make a country rich.
Right. And so there's this idea of, I think that like the crux of the book is this idea of signaling versus human capital. Can you give us a quick rundown of those two viewpoints of looking at education?
Right. So economists have two totally different stories about why education pays in the labor market. And the first one, usually called human capital theory, this just is the obvious one, that you go to school, you learn useful skills, and you then use those skills on the job. And this theory is obviously partly true. So you learn literacy and numeracy in school. Those are useful skills. So very simple. But signaling says that's only part of the story. There's another story, and that's a story where by going to school and studying subjects that are not useful at all, even subjects that you're never going to use after the final exam, even then it can still have a payoff in the labor market because you impress employers with your work. So you go and you take your Aristotle class, and of course you're not going to use Aristotle in almost any known job. But if employers see you've got an A+ in that, it's like, oh, good, well, you got an A+ in Aristotle. So if you can learn that, he can probably learn finance, which is what he actually needs to learn in order to do this job.
And then the idea is that you could go to almost all 4 years of college. You could be going to your final exam for your Aristotle class, and then you could get in an accident and not be able to retake your test and then not graduate. And because of that, that alone would greatly hurt your prospects in the job market. Is that about right?
Yeah, exactly. So that's just one part of it. That's a nice application of the signaling model, where if the relevant signal is college completion, then the fact that you're one stupid class short of graduation can mean that your application gets thrown in the trash. And of course, there are a lot of jobs where college is either totally required or virtually required.
And so what kind of difference in earnings do we see between somebody who, say, finished college versus finished high school in various levels of education?
Right. So there's just looking at the raw averages, which is the easiest thing to do. So what we see in the data that I focus on in the book. So the data is from 2011. There's more recent data, but it came out when it was too late. But anyway, so 2011, back then, if you wanted to compare someone who had finished college but not gone any further to someone who had finished high school but not finished any further, college graduate would make 73% more money on average. Now, of course, this doesn't mean that it's causal. It doesn't mean that going to college causes your income to go up by 73%. But also in the book, I go and try to figure out, well, how much of that gain is genuinely caused by the education rather than just being caused by something else. And even if you make a lot of adjustments, still seems very likely that you're getting a 40% gain in your earnings, holding everything about yourself fixed other than the fact that you've jumped through those hoops to get your college degree.
Yeah. And like you said, it's not necessarily causal. Maybe people who kind of are already predisposed to being able to graduate from college are the ones who actually enter college. Is that about right?
Yeah, that's very likely. So again, there's a lot of work that's been done on this. So people that are, that do well academically generally would have done better in the labor market even if they hadn't gone to school. And then on top of it, there's another issue, which is separate but very important, and that is just your odds of finishing. So if you are a good student and you start college, you're very likely to successfully graduate. But on the other hand, if you did very poorly in high school math, say, your chances of getting a college degree ever, even if you show up and attend, again, very slim. So people that, you know, best predictor of future performance is past performance. If you do very poorly in high school, your odds of being able to finish college just are not good at all.
So there is probably some degree of people who are smart enough and conscientious enough to perform well on a job, but for whatever reason did not earn college degrees and are therefore having a lot of trouble in the job market. So, I mean, couldn't the savvy employer somehow find those people, hire the people without the bachelor's degrees, and then, you know, beat their competition by paying them less?
It's absolutely possible. The problem is just how hard is it to find those people? So I think of this as the diamonds in the rough problem. So, you know, like you get an application or a stack of applications, and you know, maybe half of the people there don't have college degrees. And any sensible person realizes out of the people without college degrees, maybe there's two or three great workers in there. But how do you find them? Right? You'd have to, are you going to go and do 50 interviews, 47 of which are a waste of your time just to go and pinpoint those three people? And again, what are the odds that you'll even be able to pick them out successfully after just one interview? Maybe you'll need to go and hire them and have them work for you for months before you really are able to see their real metal. And again, that's the problem, is that the diamonds in the rough, they're totally out there and like no sensible person denies it, but finding them from a practical standpoint is just so costly. You know, like just hire, you know, like doing interviews is very costly for an employer. You're giving up the time of skilled, knowledgeable people to go and sift through this giant stack of, you know, giant stack of hay looking for the needles.
Yeah. So it's so costly to find the people who would cost less that it doesn't really make up for the cost savings that you would have. So coming from kind of a tech world, I've certainly seen a number of, say, software developers or software development jobs where it appears that they aren't concerned about whether somebody has a degree or not. But in those cases, it is like, let's go look at your GitHub account and see the code that you've checked in, the projects you've done. Let's look at your portfolio if you're a designer. Is that a way of signaling that is in any way replacing the signaling of having a degree?
If you've seen it happen, then I believe it. The main thing I know is that when I talk to people who work in tech and ask them, you know, how many people do you hire for programmer jobs who don't have conventional credentials? And, you know, like first thing, oh, yeah, lots. I'm like, well, how many? Like 5 out of 1,000. Oh, all right. Mm-hmm. So it's 5 more than 0, but still not very impressive. And, you know, like usually when I talk to people in the industry, they'll say the 70s and the 80s were the golden age of the uncredentialed programmer. And over time, it's just become more and more like the rest of corporate America, where if you don't have a college degree, people's reaction is, what's wrong with you? Or more likely, just to throw your application in the trash. But, you know, it's not a totally rigid system. There are chinks in the armor. And I'm always encouraging people, try to find those chinks if you, because you know, like they aren't as possible. So maybe you will be able to go and avoid wasting years of your life. But then again, don't assume it's going to happen just because you're good.
Right. And it seems like... maybe this happens in fields where people are kind of self-taught, or it's emerging. It's coming so quickly that an educational institution can't respond to produce a program to teach people how to do this thing. I mean, like now we're starting to see, probably lean startup being taught in business schools and these different methodologies that were invented by actually doing becoming formalized and then being added in schools. So is that kind of a place where you might see those chinks in the armor?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, again, that word emerging is really good, because when an industry is emerging, then almost by definition, you're going to have a bunch of talented but uncredentialed people. And when that's going on, an employer would be foolish just to say, no credential, not worth my time. But again, as things become more established and it's just part of the conventional order of things, then the odds that you've got qualified people that are skipping the normal credentials is going to be pretty low. And once it gets low, then you're not interested. And once you're not interested, then even fewer people want to try the unconventional route. And again, you get what I call locked-in syndrome, where it's a very rigid system and where it's just hard for many jobs to even be considered without the proper credentials.
And this is an issue that for me, I intuitively
understand that the education system is not working very efficiently. I went to school, I hated school, but I loved learning. And I ended up kind of creating my own job. So one of the things that I end up having trouble with letting go of in this whole argument is the idea of education teaching you useful skills, even if it's not teaching you the skills that you're learning on your job. And just as an example, I trained as a designer. I worked as a designer. I still use those skills. I don't consider myself a designer. Psychology would be a field where I learned a ton of things. I use that stuff every day in both my work and my life. It's some of the most valuable stuff that I've ever learned, but I'm not working as a psychologist. So I mean, how do you think about, I guess it's the wheat and the chaff theory of what is useful and what is not useful?
Right. So, I mean, the first obvious thing is if you forget it, then it's not going to be useful to you. And like enormous evidence that people just forget almost everything they learn, especially stuff that they don't repeatedly use. So again, it may very well be that you're remembering the stuff because you're learning it, or because you're using it rather, but most people won't. Meaning that if you were to just go and today test people took a psychology class 10 years ago and see how much of it they remember, I mean, again, like it seems pretty likely that they would be close to the level of knowledge they had before they even took the class. So there's that. I mean, in terms of, suppose you did remember it. There's also this big psychological literature on transfer of learning, which basically measures people's ability to apply something that they learn in one area of life to another area where it's logically relevant, but just not obviously relevant. And the usual result is people are terrible at this. If things do not superficially have the right labels on them, then people generally forget what is inside the box and they just don't use it. So even if you still have the knowledge somewhere in your mind, realizing, oh, well, this is the time to go and use trigonometry. Oh, well, life doesn't tell you that.
And am I remembering right? I feel like I remember there were certain fields where that learning transfer did happen with like a certain area. So if you were studying science, for example, maybe you learned certain reasoning skills. Am I remembering this correctly?
You're remembering it right in general. Actually, on the general scientific reasoning, the main studies find that even scientifically trained people don't apply science to areas outside of their scientific specialty. If you ask a medical researcher what we know about health. And then you'll often find they'll give you the same kind of unscientific answers that almost anyone else will. I mean, like, I think that like the relevant study that I cite in the book had questions like, most of the students who come to the student counseling center aren't getting enough sleep. Does this show that sleep causes mental health? And then again, like scientists, instead of saying, we don't really have a control study, and like, what's the control group? What's the treatment group? Instead, they just start giving platitudes. Well, yeah, everyone knows you need enough sleep, stuff like this. Some of the areas where they did find that there was transfer. So there was work on transfer between math and physics, showing that physics doesn't transfer well to math, but math transfers well to physics. So there's that. Where basically you either teach them the math of arithmetic progression or the physics of constant acceleration. These two subjects are basically the same thing. But if you teach them the physics and ask them to derive the math, people had a lot of trouble doing it. Teach them the math and ask them to apply it to the physics, people were quite a bit better at that. And then there are other examples that I find, again, probably the most impressive one actually was there was an experiment where they took statistics students and they either called them at the beginning of the semester or the end of the semester. And they didn't mention that the phone call had anything to do with the statistics class. They just acted like it was just a totally random sports survey. And they did find that at the end of the semester, people were giving more statistically literate answers than at the beginning of the semester. Again, of course, this is a very optimistic case because you're asking people at the very end of the semester instead of 5 years later. When again, it seems very likely they would have forgotten most of what they learned and would no longer be applying it. But again, at least there, people were applying what they learned to a practical problem without being told to do so. And again, that is a hurdle that's very hard to get people to meet in the real world.
Yeah, and that brings up an interesting point about statistics. I believe in the book you were saying that statistics is one of these things that people, it's shown that people do use statistics in their jobs. Mm-hmm. However, in high school, maybe 7% of students take a statistics class, whereas 3/4 take a geometry class and never use geometry.
Yeah. So it's like just in terms of the curriculum, it's pretty crazy where you have people spending tons of time studying stuff that almost nobody uses in adult life, whereas other subjects that there are many jobs where you might use it and then get constant practice and actually get good at it, not taught in school, or at least taught only very rarely.
And why is the curriculum that way?
Yeah. So there's sort of the close-up story or the near story and the far story. I mean, the near story is just teachers teach whatever they're taught. There's tremendous inertia in the curriculum. So basically, like once things start out a certain way, they tend to stay that way. In terms of why there's so little pressure to switch to more useful things, again, the main thing is that the status quo works for what people want, which is getting into good colleges. So that's really what the K-12 curriculum is for. That's what people care about, is my kid getting into a good college? Well, in that case, I don't really care what you're teaching as long as colleges are happy with it. Mm-hmm. So it's not that the colleges don't want you to take statistics, but they don't care. And if they don't care, then high schools don't care. Then high school students and their parents don't care. So that's where we are.
And apparently the employers don't care that the colleges don't care. Is that accurate?
Yeah. So they care a little bit. So you can see the statistics majors are going to make more money than English majors. So, employers are willing to go and give some rewards for the stuff. But again, it is striking how many people can get a job where they barely know statistics or really know next to nothing about it. And then they get hired and then they say, well, fine, you don't know it. We'll just teach you now. It's not like, part of it is it's not that big of a disadvantage just because college instruction is so poor.
And what about yourself as an economist? I believe you mentioned that economists don't necessarily use what they learn on their job, what they learn on their jobs. Yet people who major in economics are highly paid. Is mm-hmm. that because of knowledge transfer?
Yeah. So, I think the main thing is just that the economics major signals that you're pretty quantitative, that you're interested in money. And again, you're willing to jump through these hurdles of material that most people consider boring. So, and I'll put that all together and it impresses employers. So, if you go and just take a look at the highest earning majors, electrical engineering's at the top, then CS, mechanical engineering, then finance, but economics coming up a very close fifth. And again, these are all clustered together. So, I love to tell my undergraduates, economics is the highest paid of all the easy majors. And there's like, hey, don't call it easy. Like, come on. This is not like computer science. You're not disappearing into a basement for weeks and emerging with pasty white skin at the end. You can still have a nice, fun party, college party experience and get your degree in economics. We don't ask that much of you. Yeah, it's harder than a business major, but it's not that bad. But in like pays so well. So, lucky you guys.
So what kind of jobs are people who study economics getting where they're not actually using the things that they're learning in economics?
Well, let me put it this way. There's only two things that almost anyone's likely to use. And so one of them is basic statistics, and the other one is how to calculate a person's discounted value. And almost everything else you learn in economics undergraduate degree, I'd say you're only going to use it if you work for a think tank or you become an economics professor or maybe a regulator or something like that. So jobs like just any kind of a business job, office job. A lot of economists do wind up working in finance, things like that. Although even there, you got your base statistics, you got your present value knowledge, but then I bet a lot of econ majors graduate without knowing what a junk bond is. Right, and very likely. Like, what's a junk bond? Oh, a bond that's junk.
Right. So, what about the idea that, say, that education is enlightening? For example, I'm somebody who took the one thing I did enjoy was I took a lot of art classes, mm-hmm. and maybe there's I'm not well versed on this, but maybe there's some studies showing that art classes show somebody to how to be more in tune with their emotions and then become more successful in their lives or other things like that. How do you usually respond when people talk about the idea of education being enlightening?
Right. So first thing is education is extremely enlightening for a small number of people. All right. And of course, these are the kinds of people that tend to listen to podcasts. So don't go and judge this by your own experience at this point. Go and consider that, but also think about all of the Philistines that family members, friends, fellow students who did not seem to be intrinsically interested in these classes that you felt were deeply enriching for your life. So, that's the first thing. And then again, if we just go and look at the data, we got a lot of measures of consumption of high culture, things like that. And we can see is that there's so little consumption of this stuff by adults that if school caused all of it, it still would be a very small amount. So I mean, that, again, that's my main. So yeah, so it happens once in a blue moon. But again, like most people just seem to have very little curiosity for this stuff. And so they just do the bare minimum they need to get their grade and then they never do it again.
Yeah, I can say like for myself, when it came to reading classic literature, I think I was assigned some of these things in high school, but maybe I read them and didn't remember, or maybe I didn't read them. But it wasn't until I was, you know, out of college even that I started to become interested in those things. And I think that's when I really got to be enlightened. So, if I can be so bold as to say that, but in a way, it was almost like school made me resistant to those things that I might have otherwise been interested in. I don't know how you would measure that, but that's a possibility.
Yeah, I mean, so that's something where it definitely seems like we should be more open to the possibility that school is actually crushing people's interest in high culture. I mean, just think about being stuck in a Shakespeare class in high school with some kid who can barely read going, Romeo, oh, Romeo, you know, that kind of thing. It's a painful memory. Again, so again, possibly that's actually why we see so little effect, is that schools are turning off some kids at the same time that they were turning on other kids. So maybe that's what's going on. Again, people then say, well, if every kid just had the best teacher, then everything would be great. Like, well, that sounds extremely unlikely. Yeah. Everyone's getting the best. Come on. Well, how could that be?
And you mentioned something about, education being enlightening for some people, which brings up a thing that I'm sure that's on the top of everybody's mind. It's certainly one of the first things that people bring up when I talk to them about the idea of the education system being a waste of time and money, which is that, well, what about people who are underprivileged and they might not have access to education if there were to be, say, less funding for education? How would the idea of reducing resources for education affect people who wouldn't have much resources to get education?
Yeah, so I've got a section on this in the book called Signaling and Social Justice, and here is just the first background fact to keep in mind. There's been tremendous credential inflation over the last 70 years. So the amount of education that you need to get any given job has gone up a lot. I'm not just saying that there's more computer scientists now. I'm saying that to be a waiter or to be a parking lot attendant, you now need to have more education than you used to in the past. All right. Now, this is something where when you start thinking about it, say, if you didn't have much education, when was it better to be looking for a job? And I say, yeah, it was better like decades ago, back when the discrimination against a high school dropout or someone who didn't go to college would have just been a lot less. So again, when people get very worried about the effect of reducing education on the poor and disadvantaged, so they're very focused on a small number of very successful people from poor families, and they're forgetting the 90% of people from poor families who don't do very well in school right now, and who now face an enormous stigma that they wouldn't have faced in an earlier time when educational levels were just lower. So, I think it's one where, I don't think it's clear at all the current system is better on average to be poor. Although, of course, if you go and find someone from poor family who got a PhD, then it's easy to say, see, that person's better off. But what about all the other people that you're forgetting about?
We're going to take a quick break. I am so thrilled to have Skillshare back as a sponsor of Love Your Work. I know that you will love Skillshare because you are a Love Your Work listener, and Love Your Work listeners love to learn. Skillshare is an online learning platform with over 18,000 classes in business, marketing, entrepreneurship, technology, much, much more. A class that I personally really enjoyed is called Real Productivity, Create Your Ideal Week with Skillshare founder and CEO, Michael Karjanapakorn. And Michael has an impressive command over managing his time and mental energy.
If you look at my calendar, you'll see that it's color-coded. So anything that's in gray are recurring meetings. Anything yellow is a signal that anyone could put a meeting in that time block. Anything in red are like tasks or things that I do on a day-by-day basis.
Join the millions of students already on Skillshare today with a special offer just for my listeners. Get 2 months of Skillshare for just 99 cents. 99 cents, you can't buy a decent pen for 99 cents. Anyway, that is right. Skillshare is offering Love Your Work listeners 2 months of unlimited access to over 18,000 classes for just 99 cents. To sign up, go to skillshare.com/loveyourwork. Again, go to skillshare.com/loveyourwork to start your 2 months now. If you're a creative entrepreneur, You need more than just a beautiful website. You need a powerful website. Success isn't just getting your products online. It's getting your products into the hands of the customers who will love them. I'm honored to have Weebly sponsoring Love Your Work. With Weebly, you don't just get an easy-to-build website with great-looking templates. And by the way, as a designer, I have to say, Weebly's templates are stunning. With Weebly, your website is not just beautiful. You also get tons of tools to help you turn that website into a business. This means features to help promote your products, process payment, manage inventory, send marketing campaigns, and get discovered by new customers. You know, stuff that gets you paid. Stuff at the intersection of your love and money Venn diagram. Weebly is offering 15% off just for Love Your Work listeners at weebly.com/loveyourwork. That's right. As a fan of Love Your Work, go to weebly.com/loveyourwork. That's Weebly, weebly.com/loveyourwork. And you'll get 15% off when you sign up for your online store. Weebly, more than just a beautiful website. And so the basic idea being that more and more people need to have degrees just to get even a basic job that doesn't even require the things that you would learn in that degree. Yeah. And so then as a result, people who can't afford to get a degree are even worse off, perhaps.
Yeah, or can't afford or just don't like school, because there's a lot of people who don't like school. Yeah, I mean, like I was having this argument with someone and he was saying this is so unfair because, you know, just imagine someone who's from a super poor family and they have to go and take care and like their family needs them. They have to work and then they miss out on all these opportunities. And I'm saying, all right, well, fine. How about a person today who's super talented, but who hates school? And what does the current system offer that person? Mm-hmm. And it's like, why is it that person and his plight is not on the radar right now? You know, in any system you can imagine, there's always going to be some people that miss out and are mistreated. And again, it's not fair to go and say, I'm going to reject reform because I can think of someone that would be worse off under it. You need to think about what's better overall.
And I loved a certain part of the book because in high school, I actually wrote a paper about how the school system was stealing money from me because I only needed to go to school for a few hours a day to earn the credits I needed to graduate, yet they were forcing me to continue going to school. My argument was, hey, I could be working and now I have to, you know, take study hall or all these extra hours where I'm not allowed to work. What about the relationship between school and doing actual work, not necessarily knowledge work, but but jobs that need to be done?
Yeah. I mean, of course, I mean, in a way, all work is knowledge work, even just acquiring the knowledge of how to deal with customers and show up on time and get along with coworkers. This is all very valuable knowledge, maybe even more important than trigonometry. I know that's kind of hard to believe. I would say that most, at least, out of educators and education researchers think about it, they're very conscious of the danger that if students work, this could mess up their school performance. Almost no one is worried that school is messing up people's work performance, but, it's all cut from the same cloth. The main thing that most researchers find is that moderate amounts of work when you're in school don't even seem to go and hurt school performance. So it looks like students cut back on their leisure rather than on their academics when they do a moderate amount of work. If they're working a lot, that probably does hurt the school performance, which, again, normal researchers say, okay, well, in that case, they definitely shouldn't do it. Whereas I'm more inclined to say, well, yeah, it's hurting their school performance, but if what they're learning in school wasn't very socially useful, then maybe it's better, actually, at least for society, if people just go and start working at an earlier age and learning how to do practical tasks.
Mm-hmm. And so in a way, you were kind of arguing for child labor, which is like a thing that people probably resist against a lot. Can you clarify that a little bit?
Yeah. So what I say is that we have a tremendous double standard between child labor and school. So for school, if someone says, look, I'm bored and I'm really unhappy here and I'm a kid, why can't I play? The reaction is sit down, shut up, do what you're told. Life's not fair. Life's not fun. I don't care if you are a kid, do what you're supposed to do. But on the other hand, if there's a kid who has a job that he isn't particularly enjoying, then people get very weepy. It's like, oh, a child here is not able to go and play as a child. This poor thing here is being exploited and mistreated. It's so awful. And, I say it's, of course, there are some horrible jobs that children have been made to do, and that's terrible. you know, like having children mine uranium or something. But then again, of course, there have been some terrible schools. Like, as I say in the book, my mom went to a school where the nuns would hit children with sticks back in the 30s, right? And it was whack them. They were physical abuse was going on. And see, in both cases, you shouldn't go and judge present opportunities by these creepy abuses of the past. You'd say, well, what's likely to happen now? Are they really talking about having kids mine uranium? Well, no. Then what's so bad about having kids go and have a job? And like, even if it isn't very fun, still it's useful and it's giving them some good preparation and they get some money. And again, I think another thing is people get very outraged, you know, when someone's making money off of these children. It's like, so you know what? Someone makes money off of students too. The difference is that when you go to school, you are paying the school to have you there. Whereas when you're working, you're normally getting paid something at least. So, you know, like, why is it so terrible for children to work for low wages, but it's not terrible for them to work for high negative wages where they're actually getting poorer every day they're in school? I just don't see the logic.
Right. And the subjects that they are learning aren't particularly useful. Here's a quote from the book. We should be equally puzzled by the eminently practical subjects that they don't have to study. Why don't educators familiarize students with compensation and job satisfaction and common occupations, strategies for breaking into various industries, sectors with rapidly changing employment? Why don't schools make students spend a full year learning how to write a resume or affect a can-do attitude, dire sins of omission? And so, yeah, they're in school. They're kind of playing a game that is nothing like work, and then at the same time not getting to do very much work. And it seems like who benefits is the education industry. And so, I mean, I have some intuitions about this, but I'm sure you have a better view of the landscape. Who is really benefiting from this degree inflation that is going on?
Right. So my general view is when you look at a really dysfunctional system, you should consider the possibility that virtually no one is benefiting. And it's just, and like, then why is it going on? Well, because no one wants to be the first person to do something different or weird. So, again, when people say, you know, the education establishment is benefiting from this, it's like, well, seems like it's not that they don't want to go and teach some more practical stuff. It's just that no one individual wants to stick his neck out and try doing something different. I don't think that administrators are cackling with glee about the irrelevance of what they're teaching. It's just inertia. Well, this is the way we've always done it. And you say, well, why don't you change? Well, why should I change? Why should I do something different? So it's not like people are just going to get mad at me and there's not much in the way of rewards for it. So, I mean, part of it, I think of it is just the general dysfunction of the nonprofit sector. I think, you know, a lot of what's going on is just that the education system as we have is so beloved. There's so much respect and affection and deference to it from parents, from taxpayers, that it just naturally keeps going on just based upon, you know, like this love. Or in the book, I talk about what psychologists call social desirability bias. You know, education is something where we just have so much poetry about it. It's like, you know, if one child can have one great experience of the poem, that's worth any amount of money. You know, we shouldn't be counting costs when it's about the education of children. And again, this kind of thing. And it's like, well, if it was your money, you'd want to count the cost. I mean, of course you should count the cost. How can you not want to count the cost? But I mean, it's the kind of thing where it's so infused with this flowery language and poetry. And of course, if you want to, to do well in politics, you don't go and correct the public and say, you know, listen, voters, you guys need to put aside this flowery language and face facts. Instead, you want to go and say, oh, flowery language. Well, have I got some beautiful flowery words for you? And you give that speech, and that's how you get and maintain power. So, I mean, I just think of it as just a really grossly dysfunctional system. You know, I also like the metaphor of, you know, you may have heard that a giraffe is a horse designed by a committee. And again, this is what I think about the education system. It's not that someone has crafted it to serve a purpose. It's just accreted in this chaotic and strange and grotesque way. And there's no one person who actually wanted it to look this way, but each person is there tacking on their things and complaining about things. And in the end, we just get this thing that you just wonder why it exists. Well, it's like, well, it wasn't designed for anyone, for any particular purpose. It just emerges from, you know, the political process and the incentives the political process gives.
All right. And full disclosure, who we're talking to today is Brian Kaplan, who is a professor at George Mason University, which is obviously a higher education institution. I mean, how, do you feel any internal conflict over being a professor and the problems that you see in the system? Like, where do you most, what makes you most uncomfortable about your position?
I guess what makes me most uncomfortable is whenever someone puts me in a position of authority over others in the system. And that's where, you know, my instinct is to start trying to fix it. And then I find out, wow, people don't really want it fixed. And I'm just making enemies, and I'm getting, like, you know, me voting against the entire room of people. I mean, so again, that's...
Do you have any examples of that?
Yeah. So I was on a key university committee. I won't mention exactly what it was, but we're repeatedly, it was 14 people voting yes and me voting no. And I would say I was toning down my position quite a bit just to have some chance of appealing to them, but you know, people just did not see eye to eye with me at all. And again, maybe you're wrong and they're all right. And I guess that's a reasonable thing to say if you're not inside in the room. But if you're in the room, like a fly on the wall, just the cavalier attitude towards taxpayer money seems just ridiculous to me.
And the taxpayer money that an institution like George Mason gets access to, maybe through loans, because each dollar of federal loan, 12 cents is a taxpayer gift. Mm-hmm. Is that accurate?
Well, so it's true that the loans help, but I would say actually it's the grants that are the really, really big part. So again, people focus a lot on student loans because people are mad that they have to pay this money back at some point, even though the rates are really low. There's very little anger against just direct government grants funding to colleges and universities. But in terms of how much it matters, the free money is really much more important than the loans. I mean, the loans mostly you have to pay it back. So yeah, again, to my mind, this sort of shows how even when people are complaining about education, it's not the good complaints get very little attention. It's really the weakest complaints that get the most. So again, I would say, what do we really need to do about student loans? Raise the interest rate. That's what's important, right? Because the low interest rates encourage people to get education, which they are not learning socially useful skills, and it's encouraging credential inflation. But I say that actually student loan programs are one of the least dysfunctional parts of the system, precisely because the student still has a lot of skin in the game. You have this loan that you cannot discharge through bankruptcy, that you got to pay back. So at least it gives you a reason to wonder, is this a worthwhile investment? Whereas if the government just pays for the whole way, then there's very little reason to sit around second guessing whether or not you're doing a worthwhile thing. Mm-hmm. So I say that's the big problem, but it's one people aren't going to complain about because it's just shoved onto anonymous taxpayers instead of a highly visible student.
Right. And my intuition would be that since there are these grants and since there is the credential inflation, that would then cause the price of education to rise. Mm-hmm. Is that intuition correct? And how do those forces interact with each other?
Yeah, sure. So, that's right. And there's been a good amount of work done on this. Although the important thing to remember is that while subsidies cause tuition to rise, they nevertheless are still really, the reason why they increase attendance is because they are reducing the price of the student. So, if a dollar subsidies raise tuition by a dollar, then there'd be no effect on student attendance of the money. And there's also a lot of evidence that there is, that the cheaper you make it, the more students attend, and the more the subsidies are, the more they attend. It's true that there is this offsetting factor of tuition tends to go up. But again, the way that any subsidy works is by reducing the price after you adjust for the subsidy, right? So, and again, so this goes back to how people get very worked up about the high price rather than the high attendance. And I say the problem is really the attendance from a social point of view.
Oh, okay. And we were talking about the social desirability bias, which I'm sure interacts with all this stuff, and of course causes the credential inflation. And I mean, at the same time, there is a what I understand to be a middle skilled labor shortage. Here's a statistic from the National Skills Coalition. Middle job skills account for 53% of U.S. jobs, only 43% of workers. These being things like, I believe, plumbing or nursing. And so how is this social desirability bias, credential inflation, interacting with this idea of there being a middle skills job shortage or worker shortage.
Right, right. So middle skills seems too broad, but sort of the trades, that, you know, that seems totally true. And again, I mean, I think what's going on is that if you say, hey, the plumbers earn good money and there's a lot of kids that aren't going to do well in college, but they'd be good plumbers. Why don't we train them to be plumbers when they're 14 years old? If you were to say this, people will flip out at you in America. And they'll say, oh, so you know who's good and who's bad, and you can decide who gets to be a plumber and has to be a plumber and take away their opportunities. And, you know, and you say, no, everyone should be prepared for college. And then if you decide that college isn't for you, then you can become a plumber. You can never just conveniently forgetting, well, look, there's a lot of people who, if they try college and fail, will be so discouraged, they won't try being a plumber. And again, like this, like, you know, people don't want to hear, well, look, you know, the odds that someone with this kid's test scores of graduating from college is, say, 2%, and that's too low to justify keeping them on a college track. It just does, you know, it's a disservice to taxpayers as well as to the student. Why not go and find something that the student is good at and likes and pays well, right? But again, like in the United States, like there is such such antagonism to this idea of setting your sights in a realistic way, and just trying to make an accurate forecast based upon what's likely to happen. And instead, you know, like the mythology of, you know, any kid can grow up to be president, this kind of nonsense. I was just watching a new Chris Rock comedy routine where he was laughing at this and saying, like, you know, he said, well, look, you know, anyone in school can do whatever they want. No, maybe four kids can do whatever they want. Most of you, no, can't. So why don't we go and figure out something that's actually plausible?
I highly recommend that Chris Rock stand-up. It's on Netflix. Really good. Now, there is I found an interesting theory. It was on Slate, and it was full of all of the, snark that you would expect from a Slate article. But it was talking about, well, maybe this middle-skilled labor shortage is just an unwillingness to pay competitively. Mm-hmm. Businesses choose lower output and higher profit instead of feeling like they need to be forced to, say, raise their wages and attract more people. The idea being, it's called monopsony. I hadn't heard that term before. Is that a plausible argument to you?
No, it's not plausible at all. I mean, again, especially for a common occupation like plumber or electrician, really makes very little sense. Again, of course, it's true that employers don't want to raise wages. And the obvious answer when an employer says there's a shortage is to say raise wages. Basically, like in terms, in the sense that an economist would talk about, where a shortage is just where you can't get all you want to the existing wage, then I don't think it's true that there is a shortage of middle skills or anything else. When employers talk about it, it's more just like, it's surprisingly hard to find people that are good at this, especially in a given age group. I would say that it's not so much a problem of, like, the workers don't exist. It's just like we are wasting time in school training for people for jobs that they're not going to be doing when we could have been training them for jobs they are going to be doing. So, I mean, I think that's the sensible way of reframing it. But the general idea of employers, there's so few employers that they're worried that if they raise wages a bit, this is going to actually lead to a chain reaction or something like that. And then, I think that's pretty fanciful.
Mm-hmm. So I think that a lot of people who are listening to this show are really into educating themselves. They mm-hmm. want to make wise decisions. When it comes to maybe some of them are considering college or they're considering grad school, how should they think about that decision? Actually, how about this? I mean, I think that you have kids. Mm-hmm. How do you talk to them about if it's gotten to that point about their options in terms of education and how to decide what is best?
Yeah, so a lot of what I do with my kids is just to present them with facts, just to say, all right, look, so these are your grades. This is what's likely to happen for you, and then tell them about things. Find out what's interesting for you, what kinds of careers would you enjoy, and then tell them, all right, well, for that career, this is the kind of educational path you've got to go through. These are the hurdles that you have to jump over. These are the problems you're going to face, and then also let's just let them know about other kinds of job options. So if a kid has given ambition, always want to talk about it, but then also say, all right, well, let's find out. So, what does this pay? How much do people do this job actually like it? What do you have to do in order to get this job? Are there a lot of people who try to get the job who just aren't able to do it, like an actor or something like that? So I try to talk about that. In terms of, your listeners are self-starters and they're intellectually curious. I mean, I would say, you know, like having been on college campuses for like almost 30 years now, it is shocking to me how little students try to get out of the experience. You know, like on every college campus, there is full of professors who know something, right? You know, like almost every one of them has like a very nice pool of knowledge. And if you're curious, you just go talk to them, right? And again, most professors are delighted to have someone that is genuinely curious about their subject that wants to have a conversation. You know, like, you know, professors may grimace when a student shows up at their office just to argue about a grade. They don't like that. But if you show up and say, wow, you work on the French Wars of Religion, I'm so interested in that. I've got some questions for you. You know, like, and get so rare, a lot of professors will say, oh, what is this kid's scam? What is he trying to pull here? Is he selling me cookies or like what? But then finally, finally, once you convince them, no, he's really interested, actually. What I often tell people is just remember, professors, but, you know, adults in general, so many of them are so bored, they're so lonely, and they may not know it yet, but they want to be your friend. Just go up to them and approach them and express a genuine and informed interest in what they work on. And again, you will make great contacts this way, and yet so few people take advantage of these opportunities. So that's the kind of thing that I would really, really encourage people to do. If you want to go and get the most out of your education, I mean, I say, look, so go to the entire faculty roster for any department that you have any interest in, and just go down every single person's biography and see what they work on, and just say, hey, maybe, you know, 5% chance that you would get something out of talking to the person. Just go and meet and talk to them for a few minutes and see what happens. And, you know, like, and repeat. So, I mean, I say if you do like 30 meetings and three of those professors get to know you well and become your advocates and mentors, like, just think about what a fantastic rate of return you've had on that small investment of time.
Yeah, just to share my own experience with the listeners that some of them have already heard about, I at one time was thinking about getting an MBA. I looked at what an MBA would get me, which was, you know, it seemed like it'd be great to get a job at a Fortune 500 company. That wasn't something I wanted. I wanted to build my own thing. So I cashed out $40,000 worth of stock and bought myself a year and just figured things out for myself. I did my DIY MBA so I could build my own business. And now I get to invite professors, lonely professors like you, on my podcast, and they teach me things.
Yeah, well, I'm not so lonely because I'm very gregarious. So I'm the kind of person who goes and meets other people that are lonely. But still, you know, great chance to have a conversation. Sure.
Brian Kaplan, thank you so much for coming on the show. I really enjoyed this conversation. I think our listeners are going to enjoy it too. Do you have a final message for them? And also, where can they find you?
Yes. So, final message. The book is The Case Against Education, and you can get it for just $20 on Amazon. So you really cannot afford not to buy this book. Let's see, in terms of where you can meet me. So I blog for EconLog, and then I've got a massive pile of stuff at bkaplan.com that you can read as well. In terms of, you know, final messages. So I guess that when I sign books, I always give the message of be the case for education. So again, ideas and culture in my life. I love the stuff, and people that love it are people that I like to hang out with. Just realizing the fact that most people find this stuff boring doesn't mean that you have to. And I mean, just be grateful that you live in the internet age when you never need to be lacking someone to share ideas with.
Brian, thank you so much for coming on the show.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Is Love Your Work helping you find the intersection on your love and money Venn diagram? Does it bring you the inspiration and motivation to make you into the person that you want to be? If so, we, together, you and I, can make this the show that we want it to be. I'm trying to make a nourishing and thoughtful show, and I could use your help with that. Please donate to the show. Just a coffee a month will help support the hosting and production of this show. Just a coffee a month will help spread Love Your Work's message, helping more people live a balanced life with a healthy definition of success. To donate, visit our Patreon page at katavi.net/donate. Patreon is a platform that lets you support creators like me, vote with your dollars, and keep Love Your Work going at katavi.net/donate. As a thank you, you'll get early access, bonus content, and a discount on Love Your Work merchandise. Learn more at katavi.net/donate. That's katavi.net/donate. Love Your Work is made possible by top supporters such as Arif Akhtar. This has been Love Your Work, and I'm David Cadavy. The theme music for this show is At Sea by Durena from the album About Everything and More by arrangement with Deep Elm Records at deepelm.com. Love Your Work is a production of Cadavy, Inc.